Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, predecided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look at these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make, if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if we can dispose properly and then answer properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, I want to thank you for your disclaimer that you've given us tonight. I want to share and start, ladies and gentlemen, by saying that tonight's special, we're going to have a guest speaker who will be joining us after I share with you about the 14th Amendment. This guest speaker, his name is Scott, is going to be a new information provider at Your Remedy is in the Law. He was recommended by GW. Because there are issues surrounding some people who are alleged to have debt to the IRS, delinquent debt to the IRS, alleged debt, and that he has a solution which he's going to be sharing with you tonight. And it will be an affordable solution compared to hiring the team to go in there and obliterate, and I use that word allegorically, please, to obliterate the IRS's contention that you have a debt with them. So we're going to listen to him tonight and know that we're putting together his efforts for you. Anyone on this call, I've started reaching out today to people, anybody on this call that is involved with the Correct My Status program and has in excess of $50,000 in delinquent debt to the IRS, you need to reach out to me. And because there are some changes that we need to work with you on with regards to the DS-11 being successfully employed in your 15-minute meeting. All right, so that having been said, let me start talking about the 14th Amendment. John Kruzel is a staff member at the news group known as PolitiFact, and he previously covered politics at ABC News, where he received an Emmy nomination for his work on the 2016 presidential debates. In a recent editorial, Kruzel wrote that President Trump with his mega membership supporters were, quote, subverting democracy, end quote. Paul Andrew Mitchell, who is the founder of Supreme Law, wrote an editorial piece to John Kruzel and said the following. Greetings, John Kruzel, care of the editors. Can you please explain to us why the word democracy stubbornly continues to appear in internet news headlines when the guarantee clause of the United States Constitution mandates something entirely different? We're only half joking when we challenge you to ask all of your staff writers if 27 actually does equal 28. More on that in a moment. Nebraska had been admitted to the Union. And so the Secretary of State, in transmitting the proposed amendment, announced that ratification by 28 states would be needed before the amendment would become part of the Constitution. Since there were at that time 37 states in the Union, a rejection by 10 states would thus defeat the proposal. In order to have 27 states ratify the 14th Amendment, It was necessary to count those states which had first rejected and then under threat, duress, and coercion of military occupation, then ratified, and then also to count those states which initially ratified, but then subsequently rejected the proposal. What amazes us to no end is the refusal of so many would-be journalists even to consider the gross voting rights violations that occurred when the Union Army reinvaded the southern states in retaliation for voting against the so-called 14th Amendment proposal. Weren't these the same southern states counted upon to ratify the 13th Amendment banning slavery and involuntary servitude? Do you or do you not see any problems with that second military invasion? How about this realistic comparison? The next time you vote in a presidential election, we will wait outside your voting booth and then threaten you at the point of a bayonet and with a court-martial if you do not change your vote to our preferred candidate. Totally legal, right? No? Oh, illegal. Criminal? Here's the answer. The population of federal citizens who now inhabit the 50 states of the Union are by definition an absolute legislative democracy that is domiciled in the District of Columbia, where the guarantee clause, strictly construed, does not apply. The evidence has been staring everyone in their face for many decades, quote, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, end quote, means subject to the municipal jurisdiction of the Congress. It must mean that, because the jurisdiction of each state of the Union is carefully mentioned in the second half of that section 1, quote, within its jurisdiction. In this raging and self-destructive democracy, Congress claims it can even dictate what toothpaste you can use and not use. And federal courts will go along with such a ridiculous scam. So, with that having been said, let's now talk about the 14th Amendment, one slave master traded for another slave master. Let's talk about Americans of African descent for the moment. Firstly, the Emancipation Proclamation wasn't law. That is not where the African slaves were freed. Furthermore, it wasn't apportioned among the states. It was only for the South. Northern states and border states were not included in this proclamation. It was only until the 13th Amendment did freedom for African slaves become law. And it wasn't until the 14th Amendment that these former slaves became this unique term, persons, in law, with the ability to sue and be sued. No American of European descent gave a second thought to the 14th Amendment at the time of its passing. As state citizens of these freely associated compact states, which are united by and under the Constitution, which is quoting Black's Law Dictionary, 4th, 5th, and 6th edition, defining United States, they enjoyed natural rights in a republican form of government. These newly made U.S. citizens, former slaves, fictions created by the Congress, only enjoyed civil rights, or actually mere privileges, under the designated territories over which the sovereignty of the United States extended with a democratic form of government. Again, quoting Black's Law Dictionary, 4th, 5th, and 6th edition of the term United States, because there's three definitions, folks. I just named two of them. Any child born of a slave before the 14th Amendment, as were their parents, they needed to have the 14th Amendment to have so-called equal rights, as at least the appearance of natural rights. Any child born to a former slave after the 14th Amendment didn't need the 14th Amendment, as these Americans of African descent enjoyed the same natural rights as Americans of European descent as state citizens. So the question begs today, why hasn't the 14th Amendment been repealed? Could it not have been repealed because it was highly profitable not to? Was one plantation of a few thousand acres successfully traded for a plantation of a few billion acres? Today, sadly, by way of their gross ignorance, both aforementioned parties have totally missed the most important part to standing in law, that is, jurisdiction, both personam and territorium. Here are a few interesting cases that outline the difference between one class of land and people and the other. And I've copied and pasted an article I wrote to in response to Hillsdale College's comments regarding civil rights. So the question is, in which jurisdiction do you live? In the United States versus Cruikshank, this is found at 92 U.S. 542. This is an 1875 court case right after the Civil War. It says, quote, "We have in our political system a government of the United States and a government of each of the several states. Each one of these governments is distinct from the others, and each has citizens of its own who owe its allegiance and whose rights within its jurisdiction it must protect. The same person may be at the same time a citizen of the United States and a citizen of a state, but his rights of citizenship under one of these governments will be different from those he has under the other. As stated in the legal tender cases found at 110 U.S. 421, this is another decade later, 9 years later, 1884, and it's also referred to in the court style of Juilliard versus Greenman. And I quote, "In the United States of America, we the people are sovereign over and above that of the government, as much as the government only has the authority to have those specific powers that have been delegated to it through our constitutions. But be that as it may, there is no such thing as a power of inherent sovereignty in the government of the United States. It is a government of delegated powers, supreme within its prescribed sphere." What is that prescribed sphere? Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. "But it is powerless outside of that sphere. In this country, sovereignty rests in the people, and Congress can exercise no power which they have not, by their Constitution, entrusted to it. All else is withheld." So what is the meaning behind these specific court decisions? You've heard them before on the call. Let's do it again. We have some new people here tonight. Maxwell versus Dow, 20 SCR 448 at page 455. Quote, "The privileges," it didn't say rights, did it? "The privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States do not necessarily include all the rights protected by the first 8 amendments to the federal Constitution against the powers of the federal government," end quote. U.S. versus Valentine, 288 F. Sup. 957, quote, "The only absolute and unqualified right of a United States citizen is to residence within the territorial boundaries of the United States." Wheeling Steel Corporation versus Fox, 298 U.S. 193, "Therefore," quote, "therefore, the U.S. citizen," open bracket, "citizens of the District of Columbia," close bracket, "residing in one of the states of the Union are classified as property and franchises of the federal government as a individual entity," end quote. Hendricks versus Maryland, SC Reporters edition, this is 1914. Quote, "A U.S. citizen, upon leaving the District of Columbia, becomes involved in interstate commerce as a resident and does not have the common law right to travel of a citizen of one of the several states." You know, anyone on this call that's got a ticket, what would the judge say if you asked the judge, "Hey, why don't I have a common law right to travel? It says so here that I do." Good question, isn't it? City of Dallas versus Mitchell, 245 Southwest 944, quote, "The rights of the individuals are restricted only to the extent that they have been voluntarily surrendered by the citizenship to the agencies of government," end quote. You didn't know that you voluntarily gave up your rights, did you? Wadley versus Newell, Circuit Court, North District of California, this is 1905, quote, "Civil rights under the 14th Amendment are for federal citizens and not state citizens. Federal citizens, as parents, have no right to the custody of their infant children except subject to the paramount right of the state," end quote. Perry versus United States, 294 U.S. 330, 353. This is a 1935 court case. Quote, the Congress, as the instrumentality of sovereignty, is endowed with certain powers to be exerted on behalf of the people in the manner and with the effect the Constitution ordains. The Congress cannot invoke the sovereign power of the people to override their will as thus declared. Houston versus Moore, 18 U.S. 1, 33. Now, this is going back way before the Civil War. This is actually not long after our country was formed in 1820 is this decision. Quote, every citizen of a state owes a double allegiance. He enjoys the protection and participates in the government of both the state and the United States, end quote. Moore versus Illinois, 55 U.S., 1320. This is 1852, still before the Civil War. Quote, every citizen of the United States is also a citizen of a state or territory. He may be said to owe allegiance to two sovereigns and may be liable for punishment. That's may, not is. May be liable for punishment for an infraction of the laws of either. Give me one second here. I have to find out what's going on with this recording. Okay. Scott, I'm going to mute you out for just one second. I'm getting a feedback from you. And give me one moment, please. And we'll be right back to you. Scott is first time calling in. He's going to be our guest speaker tonight, like I said earlier. All right. Back to United States versus Cruikshank, 92 U.S. 542, 551. Quote, it is the natural consequence of a citizenship which owes allegiance to two sovereignties and claims protection from both. He owes allegiance to the two departments, so to speak, and within their respective spheres must pay the penalties which each exacts for disobedience to its laws. In return, he can demand protection from each within its own jurisdiction. This is critical because here, if you're on United States land, land of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, you're under their laws. But if you're in Florida or Texas or Maine, you're not under their laws. You're under Florida's laws, Maine's laws, Texas's laws. Continuing, everything that we've just talked about demonstrates two governments, one with rights and the other with privileges. One a republic, the other a democracy. One where your creator is the Almighty One, whom people call God. The other is the Congress. Have you ever wondered why your, quote, right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, end quote, is infringed with licenses and so many stipulations you can't have a fully automatic battle rifle, right? That's because you are deemed a 14th Amendment citizen with only one right, and that is to live among the state citizens within the freely associated compact states who enjoy their natural rights from the Creator and not the civil rights from the Congress. Again, remember, United States versus Valentine, 288 F. Sup. 957, quote, the only absolute and unqualified right of the United States citizen is to residence within the territorial boundaries of the United States, end quote. And also remember that this right comes from the Congress and not from the Supreme Judge of the universe, as acknowledged in our Declaration of Independence. It's as simple as that. Each and every court hearing should begin with the state entering into evidence the land jurisdiction as well as the personam jurisdiction. Otherwise, how can we possibly know what defenses to mount? Very simple. Lastly, prior to the alleged ratification of the 14th Amendment, there was no legal definition of a citizen of the United States, as everyone had primary citizenship in one of the several states in this union. The Constitution referred to the sovereign state citizen, and it referred to no one else. Those who went to Washington, D.C. or outside the several states were commonly called citizens of the United States. In the Constitution for the United States of America, the term was used to identify state citizens who were eligible under the suffrage laws to hold office and they were required under the Constitution to have primary allegiance to one of the several states. Since the term was not specifically defined in the United States Constitution, Congress, in 1868, took advantage of this term and utilized it in the so-called 14th Amendment to describe a new type of citizen whose primary allegiance was to the federal government, that is Washington, D.C., and not to any one of the several states of the Union. Thus, using the term as used in the U.S. Constitution, this misled people, confused the people as to the true intent and meaning of the Constitution. Many people have mistaken the citizen as denominated in the 14th Amendment to mean the same as the one in the original Constitution. This is an error. The citizen of the United States, as used in the Constitution, was expressed entirely in lowercase script writing. And it was not the same as the citizen of the United States used in the 14th Amendment, which had a lowercase c on citizen, but United States was capitalized, capital U and capital S. So all the elected officials that we have are not sitting in their office constitutionally. They're merely imposters created by the 14th Amendment. The current president is a U.S. citizen, and therefore not the citizen of the United States as expressed in the Constitution, all lowercase, defined in the Constitution for the United States, and neither the federal senators nor any of the Congress critters are seated constitutionally. These facts being true, then all federal laws are invalid for want of constitutionality. The 14th Amendment creates and defines citizenship of the United States. It has long been contended and has been held by many learned authorities and had never been judicially decided to the contrary, that there was no such thing as the United States, except by first becoming a citizen of some state. U.S. United States versus Anthony, 874. We covered that before. We have in our political system a government of the United States and a government of each of the several states. Each one of these governments is distinct from the others, and each has citizens of its own who owe its allegiance and whose rights within its jurisdiction, there's land, it must protect. The same person may be at the same time a citizen of the United States and a citizen of the state, but his rights of citizenship under one of these governments will be different from those he has under the other. Again, quoting Cruikshank. In other words, you do not have to be a citizen of the United States in order to be a state citizen. And this was held to be true by the Maryland Supreme Court as recently as 1966, where it stated, quote, both before and after the 14th Amendment to the Federal Constitution, it has not been necessary for a person to be a citizen of the United States in order to be a citizen of his state. This was decided in Cross versus Board of Supervisors of Elections, 221A2nd, 431. Again, 1966 decision. The federal government was never given any authority to encroach upon the private affairs of the citizens in the several states of the Union, unless they were involved in import or export activity. Neither were they given authority to reach a citizen of living in Germany. In fact, the states could refuse to enforce any act of Congress that they felt was outside the intent of the granting of limited powers to the federal government. And this is called interposition or nullification. Several state Supreme Courts have in the past refused to uphold federal laws within their states. So this concludes my presentation on the 14th Amendment. Hope you enjoyed it. We do have tonight, and I'm very pleased to introduce to you Scott. Scott is a new information provider here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. And Scott has something to share with you specifically regarding those of you who have IRS issues. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the call over to Scott. Go ahead, buddy.
Hello, everybody. I'm new to this and really don't know where to start. So be patient. But essentially, the IRS doesn't have any authority unless you give it to them. not unlike what you just heard a moment ago. It's you volunteer into the system. One way to look at it is our military. Our military is a voluntary, all-voluntary military. It's once you sign an agreement to go into it, they hold you. They'll, as soon as you finish signing that document, they'll whisk you off into a boot camp, from what I've heard. I've never been in the military, so I can't honestly say, but this is the stories that I've heard, is that they just whisk you off and you're in boot camp and you obey or you get punished, whatever that punishment is, whether it's digging ditches or whether it's going to their jail. The IRS is very similar in as much as it's voluntary. Income tax is if you look around what they don't say, what it basically comes down to is it's a corporate profit tax while involved in international or interstate commerce. And so if you're not involved in that, you don't owe an income tax. That means you have to be a corporation first and foremost. Second is you have to be involved in international or interstate commerce. That's where the federal government has jurisdiction. So a profit is basically not all that you earn. A profit is what you earn after you pay off everything. So a corporation has expenses, advertisement, wages, and whatever other expenses corporations have, probably legal, also maintenance on their equipment, so on and so forth. What's left over is considered to be profit, and that doesn't include paying people who own shares. So people who own shares are not supposed to be paying taxes either, because that's a different category. So you have your profit that's left over after everything's been paid off. So the company can never really be hurting, even if they gave out 100% of their profit. They only hurt because they want to whine and complain and get you guys to pay their taxes. So how you volunteer into the IRS tax system is you send them a form. Doesn't matter what kind of form, it's an IRS form. You volunteered into their system. And once you're into their system, you have to comply. That's why they call it voluntary compliance. For a long time, I didn't understand what voluntary compliance meant because it seemed like an oxymoron. You can't be punished if you volunteer for something, but you can be punished if you don't comply. Now, these two seem opposition to each other until you learn about the all-voluntary military. And once you start understanding that it's voluntary, then it kind of starts to make sense. You volunteered into the IRS system by sending off a 1040 form, and nobody ever told you that. What you were told is by family, by friends, by employers, by media, that you have to. None of them are tax experts. They have been lied to, and so they pass the lie on to you. It's one of the best ways to pass a lie off to somebody as being real and truthful is by convincing other people that it's real. And then they don't have to answer the question. But when push comes to shove, they can't answer the basic questions. And it's income taxes is so ingrained into our system that most people say, oh, no, you're just full of it, and so on and so forth. And when I ask them, okay, show me the law that makes me liable for income taxes, they go, I don't know anything about it. It's not my area. I don't know. But you have to, because people go to jail if you don't pay income taxes. And I said, no, people go to jail for lying on their tax forms, for trying to hide information. And some of them are valid concerns because they're corporations trying to hide their profits. And
make up things. So you've heard of corporations creating other corporations so they can hide their losses, so that that company is a dump, basically. And that's designed so they can keep more of the profits for themselves. Then that becomes fraud because they're lying on their tax forms that they either have to or need to do. I'm not even sure that a corporation is liable for income taxes either, because when you look into the IRS code, there's no punishment for income taxes. And I believe that's set up that way because they don't want to separate or distinguish between who is and who isn't liable. So in a sense, nobody is liable, but everybody thinks they're liable. So once you start to understand that, you file a form, you are now part of the IRS system, you have to comply and you have to tell the truth. You sign a document under penalty of perjury, and if you get caught lying, they will come after you. next is people will tell you that they get their authority under Section 601, I believe, because I believe it says something to the effect every person liable must file an income tax form or a tax form. I don't think it says income. I think it says tax form. And every person liable doesn't make you liable. And that's where it took me a long time to make that leap, because I kept on thinking, well, it says right there, every person liable has to file a form. And that's not what it says. Well, it is what it says, but that's not how most people read it. They read it as every person is liable, and it does not say that. What makes you liable? Well, there's nothing in there that makes you liable other than your volunteering. They will never tell you that. So if you look into Section 6, this is under Title 26, IRS code. If you look under Section 6012, I believe, it talks about exemption. And you will notice, if you actually look at it, let's see if I can actually find it on my paper. That's not it. Let's see. Persons required to make returns of income. General rule. Returns with respect to income taxes under Subtitle A shall be made by the following. Every individual having a taxable year income which equals or exceeds the exempted amount, except that a return shall not be required of an individual who is not married. And if you look at all the places that it says who is not married, surviving spouse, a head of household, surviving spouse, you will notice that none of them relate to a corporation, because a corporation can never be head of house. A corporation can never be married. They can merge with other corporations, but that is not a marriage. So you have who's not married, who is married, surviving spouse, the non-surviving spouse, head of household, and non-head of household. So whether there are multiple things right there that would allow anybody, absolutely anybody, to claim exempt. And on your, is it W-2s or W-4s? I always get those confused. Whatever it is that you send into the company, there's a place where they have you determine how many exemptions. No, that's not the correct word. How many dependents you want to claim. If you read through it, you always find some place that says exempt. and you just follow the rules that allows you to claim exempt. And one of the statements is that you did not owe any income taxes the previous year and that you're not required this year and don't expect to the following year. Well, you never owed any taxes, so you can claim exempt. And that's the basis of how we get started, is that you are able to claim exempt. So what I do is I help people claim exempt. You have to determine whether or not you want to leave whatever you paid into an income tax system. Like now, this is July. So you've had, so a lot of you have paid 6 months into the system. That could be quite a big chunk of money. Do you want to make this your last tax year that you want to do it, or do you want to just kiss it all goodbye and move forward? Because the IRS does not like giving up money, and it makes it really difficult to go. You can, but it becomes more of a battle. And the one thing we don't like to do, or I don't like to do, is be confrontational. I want this smooth, and I want to be as polite as possible, but also want to be firm and make statements. Because as soon as you receive a letter, that is your trial. Whatever letter it's from, whether it be from, Motor Vehicle Division, IRS, Social Security, that first letter is your trial. They say something that you must do. You either comply or you are fighting with them. You're in an argument. So you want to make sure that you cover all your bases with any type of response. Because you don't want to go non-responsive, because non-responsive means that you agree with whatever it is they say. Whether you're President of the United States or whether you're a homeless guy on the street, if you don't counter, then you agree. You have accepted their determination. And if their determination is that you owe money, you either pay or they will take action against you. And when they take action against you, then they go into the next level. They could take you to court if you're fighting back or anything. I have some noise on there.
That was it.
There we go. So that's your first battle. So you want to make sure that you ask all the important questions that you can in that first response. And most of them, if you were to follow their code, they would lead you down to where you are, where they claim that you are involved in alcohol, tobacco, cigarette tubes, cigarette, tobacco, I think like crabbing or fishing or something of that nature. Basically, the way I look at it is anything that was part of the Southern states, because it was a punishment for them during the Civil War. And whatever side you're on as far as that Civil War goes, it was bad versus bad. The government had no right to declare war on itself. Congress has to declare war, and if half of Congress leaves, you cannot get a majority to declare that war. So it was the federal government battling the states, and the states lost. And democracy began, and the republic kind of fell asleep. So you want to refute everything that's there. And depending upon what kind of letter you get, because they have several, and I think I've received them all at one time or another, and I refuted them, and they've gone away. Once they send off that particular letter, they don't send that particular letter again, unless it's for a different year. And because I had multiple years and they would not send them all at one time, I had to do this several times. But bottom line is, they never got a dime out of me. And I've helped other people do the same. Some people had, most of the people that I talked to were saying that the IRS is claiming they owe more taxes than they've ever made in a year or in sometimes in their life. And this helps against that because you're claiming that they acted in fraud. And how you do that is basically you're telling them, number one, that none of the people that you heard from, let me see if I can actually, well, I won't do that because I have to look through it. That basically the people that encourage you to file that first form were not tax experts and did not show you the law and did not do anything. So to enter into a contract, you have to be knowingly, willingly, intentional, and voluntary. Anything outside of that null and void the contract. If you were not told you're giving up your rights, if you were not told that you didn't owe any income taxes and this is voluntary and that you're willing to give them your money, it's all fraud. And fraud vitiates any valid contract. So once you get into that system, you can get out of it. You let them know what it is you now know and bring it up to them so they have the opportunity to fully talk about it or work it out with you, which they have never done since. But you give them that opportunity because you're not trying to act in fraud with them as they did with you. You're just trying to get things straightened out, worked out, and then respond. So once you do that, then you wait, because it usually takes them a while to get it into their thick little heads and everything, and they may send you a second letter, and then that becomes a criminal trespass. And what you do then is, as the executor of your estate is everything you own or imagine. So if you have an invention, that's part of your imagination, whether it's an actual one or whether it's one that's just on paper, that's your property. A book is your property. Film, movies, anything. Intellectual property, that's all part of your estate. When you die, you have an estate sale. So anything and everything that's in that estate sale is still your estate while you're living. And you, as such, who's in charge of that estate? The executor is in charge of that estate. And that would be you. You're the executor. And this was also created from the Civil War, I believe. If we go back further into England, where most of our laws originated, or concepts originated anyway, there was a 70K trust set up, and that was based on people going overseas and never coming back, and or the Black Plague, which wiped out a third of Europe. You have abandoned property that was sitting, nothing was being done. And you remember that those days, land was extremely important because it grew food. Well, if there's nobody there to allow the serfs to grow the food, whether they be immigrants, aliens, as we call them today, but they were immigrants back then, or foreigners, or whether they were just poor people who were trying to eke out a living, the farmland needed to be grown in order to feed people, whether it be them or whether it be the higher-ups, kings and duchesses and all those other people that went on there. And so they had to have a way to transfer the property into somebody else's hands, whether they be greedy or otherwise. And the SETI K Trust was developed. Well, the other problem to that is if somebody is declared dead and then they show up, are they entitled to their land back? Absolutely. And once they show up, they can say, get off my land, because they're the true owners. They never sold it. It was taken from them by a corporation to deliver to somebody else. And when we went through a civil war, some of the states, I know New York has codified that into their system. So it's predominant everywhere, whether they have it codified or not. This is how they're treating you. This is how they're acting on you. So the IRS is actually acting as the executor of your estate, making determinations based on what they want. And you can't do anything until you step into the light and say, I'm the executor. This is my estate. You don't have any authority here. Go away. And they have to. At least so far, from what I've seen, they go away. And then that's the end of it.
Okay. Let me start with a few questions, if I may. How long have you been assisting people with this?
Since around 2012, I'm thinking.
Okay, 10 years, a decade.
Yeah.
And what kind of track record have you enjoyed in that decade?
From what I can tell, nobody's come back to me and says, it didn't work. No one. There have been some people that have had some difficulties, and we might have had to send a second letter. But essentially, once you do this, you're out.
Okay. What you shared with me earlier was one letter. Was that the first letter or the second letter?
There's two letters, both different. One is the response letter so that you can put down your legal claim to that you are claiming now you're exempt, and this is why, and asking them questions so that you give them the opportunity to respond. The second letter is an executor letter that says this person is is doing something illegal. They don't have any authority over my estate. Leave me alone. And you send a copy of that to the governor, secretary of state, and attorney general of your state and or the state that you were born in.
Okay. Really there's two processes that you'll be offering then. One is let's just call it a short game, and the other one a long game. The short game is what people on this caller list are interested in. They're attempting to correct their status. They have a past due alleged debt with the IRS, and it's over $50,000. So the IRS is not going to deliver them a passport for their after they've corrected their status. So that's one thing you're doing. That's the two letters that you've mentioned, correct?
Yes.
And about how long does it take for those two letters to percolate if you have to use two letters?
Well, it would depend on when you want to get started. If some people, like I said, this is 6 months into the year. Some people pay quite a bit of into the taxes, and they want to claim it back. I don't know how much taxes they get back, but it's based on your past years. Do you get a lot back? Do you get a little back? If you get a little back, then just count it all gone and start now. And it will, if you got started now, if you went exempt, you would send off a response letter And then probably around January or so, you will get another letter from the IRS saying, hey, you didn't file your form. You didn't do this. You didn't do that. What's going on? Because you got to remember there's a lot of IRS agents, and most of them don't have a clue to what's going on. And they don't want to tell each other because IRS agents are kept in the dark on purpose as well. And so then you just send them off. You send an executor letter off at that time, and you send it to, I believe it's the IRS commissioner who gets the main letter and is telling them, tell your people to back off. Essentially, that's not the exact words we use, but it's essentially that. And we send a copy of their letter to us that we receive and tell them to stop. And we send a copy of that, like I said, to the governor, to the secretary of state, and to the attorney general of the state you live in that this took place, and also your birth state. I don't know if you need to send that many, but that's what was recommended to me originally, and that's what I've been doing since. And then
so
you usually don't hear from them anymore.
Okay. Are you saying, though, that – but what do they actually expunge the debt?
Or
they hold it over to you.
They're not claiming, and they're not taking you to the court, and they're not going after you. So I would assume that the debt is gone at that point.
Yeah. All righty.
I don't ask because I don't want to get sucked back into their system by saying, oh, now I sent them some kind of information, and they say, oh, you went back into our system. No, once those letters go out, that's you don't talk to them anymore.
Mm-hmm. All righty. And you've done this for a decade now, and not one of your people that you've assisted. How many people do you think, just, you know, wetting your fingers, sticking it up in the air, how many think over the 10 years that you've assisted?
I would say a couple hundred.
Okay. All right. Mucho gusto. So I have a lot of people here. I'm confident we'll have questions for you. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. Press star 2. I see Michael from Las Wages, Nevada is here, so we'll start with him. Go ahead, Michael.
Yes. So we know they committed fraud because it's all contractual. So according to the federal law, then they violated the Miranda Act. Is that correct?
They would if they continued, because you volunteered into the system. You sent off a 1040 form way back when, probably your first job, because your employer told you had to, because your newspapers told you had to, television told you had to, your family, your friends, your relatives, everybody told you, oh, this is what you do, and you probably complied. So as far as they know, you knew what you were doing. They make an assumption that you know what you're doing, even though there's all this lies and fraud going around you. They didn't tell you to. They never said, hey, file this form. Never. It's you filed it. They made the assumption you knew what you were doing. So at that point, they have not committed fraud as such. They only commit fraud once you bring it to light, saying, I was never told. Now, once you kind of do that, you kind of open up a box that says, oh, this guy never knew what was going on. And the reason he didn't know, because I make sure this is in the letters, that the media told, the friends and families, and so on and so forth. They're the ones who misled this person. IRS is innocent. They're only guilty if they contact you a second time, which is then why we send the executor letter saying, hey, take care of this. We send it to the commissioner, and then you don't hear from them.
Five years ago, I sent a notice rebuking all of it without the United States to the Supreme Court, Department of Commerce, Secretary of Secretary of State, to the IRS Commissioner, and to the Supreme Court. I never heard back from them.
Typically, you won't hear from them because they don't want to get in trouble of committing fraud. And that's what I was saying, that once you bring it, once you make a statement, that statement stands until it's either corrected or, well, basically until it's corrected, if it's not correct. If it's anything you do after that point, after you've asked them questions, after you made statements, it's basically your word, your position, and it's ground, it's solid ground for you to do whatever it is you want to do until somebody says, hey, you can't do that.
Right, right. Okay, well, that's what
so
I...
So if you've contacted these people and they haven't responded to you, then you have every right not to, or to do whatever what you said in your letters. If it was, I'm not paying taxes anymore, then you can quit paying taxes.
So I sent it either certified or registered mail, return receipt requested.
Okay.
Anyway, I'll have to look through the file to find them, but I've got it.
Okay.
I don't want to get into a pissing match with them. I just want to move forward from here. And as a non-resident alien, they still want to take the tax. But that's the employer.
They still want to take your taxes?
Well, the employer, the first check that I got, they took $800, and I filed non-resident alien W-8 bin with them. But they had to call their tax guy, and then he got back, so that's for foreign nationals or something. And then I started asking him questions. I said, well, did your tax guy read all 74,000-plus pages of the tax code? He said, probably not. And then I asked him, have you read any of the tax code? He said, no.
Yeah. So, again, you have people who don't know anything telling you what you need to do. And it, so the IRS hasn't committed fraud against you because they haven't done anything.
Well,
it's
right now, it's just
the employer.
All these
other people who are bouncing around trying to get you to do something.
Right.
And you, it's hard to claim fraud on them because they don't receive anything. You know, it's like me going up to you saying, you owe Joe Smith over here $1,000, and Joe didn't say squat. And I'm the one putting pressure on you, but I'm not receiving anything, so you can't say that I'm stealing from you because I haven't taken anything. You know, so this is the system that we're in. And it's difficult, but not impossible to get out. I had a friend who had to argue with his employer quite a bit in order to get him to put him exempt because he was scared out of his mind that this employee was going to get him into trouble and he was going to have to pay the taxes and all this other kind of stuff. And when he finally submitted and backed off and everything, he hasn't had any problems since. So
a lot of it is
just in their mind that you really have to fight against because it's so ingrained into our ideas that, you know, death and taxes, you know, and that's not true.
Well, I know that the employers, if they're withholding agents, they're not, and an agent's supposed to get paid, they don't get paid, so they can't be a withholding agent.
That's correct.
Okay, well, I want to listen to what other people have to say now. I got to go back to work. I'm working night shift.
Oh, that's fun. Okay.
All right,
thank you very much,
Michael. Yes, sir. Next is Kent. Kent, you asked for a speaker. I got you a speaker.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you, Scott, for coming on and talking to us. Four different issues. I asked the question prior about the issue of the master file when we were talking with GW about the correction of status, and the general opinion or general thought was that the master file didn't need to play a part into that, and one did not need to request that. So, number one, I'd like your thoughts on what weight the master file plays in any of these processes that you're talking about.
It might be interesting to look at, but it doesn't play any kind of role into anything that we're doing. You might be interested to see how they have you designated as either a drug smuggler or a gun smuggler or some other criminal activity. But it's not something we use in any of our documents. I don't see why we would need to do that. We're just asking them questions and getting them to shut up on all points.
Okay. Now, in that same arena, I want to pursue a little further what Mike was saying about how you're actually extinguishing prior debt for, in this case, the specific purpose of being able to get a passport and execute on the DS-11 form. You had said that you don't do this adversarially, or you don't like to do it adversarially or confrontationally. Would it then be appropriate that for someone that has such a debt, although that may not solve the immediate problem, because I didn't hear in what you said, and correct me if I'm wrong, a direct resolution for that problem as it was brought forth, to immediately or almost immediately be able to execute on the DS-11 form and get the passport and the card. So would it be appropriate with the letters you're talking about to thereby demand the refund of all monies and the cancellation of all prior debts, in other words, correction back to the beginning, and then presumably they don't refute that, and then basically you have at least something to move forward on that they have not challenged you and they have not answered you? Could you expand on that a little more?
I honestly can't say, because I don't know of anybody who has told me that they attempted to get a passport and they've been denied or that they've been accepted. So I don't know how that plays out at this time. I'm prepared to go get my passport any day whenever I think about it. I gathered up all my materials and information, and I'm in the same boat as everybody else. I haven't been paying taxes for a very long time. And so I can't say even from personal experience whether I've been denied or not. Hopefully, maybe the next time I talk to somebody, I will have more information on that, because I just haven't – I forgot about it. I set it aside, and I had all my materials in an envelope and ready to go and everything, and I just kind of forgot about it. So I don't know. I don't believe that there would be an issue, but that is my belief, not necessarily a fact or anything. Again, like I said, I can't say.
Well, in your two letters, to date that you talked about, do you ask for an extinguishment of the past debt and or a refund of all monies paid in addition to not participating in this system from this day forth? In other words, ab initio, nunc pro tunc, or is that not in those letters?
I don't recall. It's been a while since I've done those letters. I did do one just recently, but I have it set up so it's fairly easy for me to go through it, and I don't read everything anymore. I don't recall asking for refunds. I don't see why you couldn't ask for a refund, but I wouldn't expect any refund. And as far as extinguishing the debt, if you never owed it in the first place, there's nothing to really extinguish. But you can ask for that. I don't see there would be an issue on that either. But like I said, I wouldn't expect a check from them. They are who they are, you know, and then once you get into that kind of arena, then you're being adverse,
adversarial. And because you're saying that you owe me money when they'll just turn around and say, well, you volunteered it to us. You gave it to us. You didn't have to. And then you say, well, yeah, but it was done in fraud. And they say, well, we didn't commit the fraud. Now, did we? We thought you knew what you were doing. You didn't. Whose fault is that? Is that our fault? You know, and the IRS will claim to be innocent and all this other kind of stuff. Maybe they'll give it back. You might win or something. But that's why I tell people you have to decide when you want to do this, whether you just kind of kiss the money goodbye, because it's a lot easier than trying to hang on to it. Or if you're going to wait till the end of the year, go exempt, and then that following April when they send you a letter saying, hey, you would send them your last refund request and then accept whatever they give you, whatever it is. And then when they send you another letter at some point in time, you just send them a response letter saying, hey, I'm out of the system. That, to me, seems the easiest. Either, like I said, either kissing it goodbye. If you wanted to stop now, some people say, I don't care how much money I've spent this far. If I can get, 33% increase, because I think that's how much state and federal income taxes are taken out of your check. At least it was last time I looked, which has been several decades ago. When I tell people, they get a 33% increase in their check, they're happy. So you have to decide. Like I said, you can ask for. You can even demand, but if they don't give it to you, just walk away from it.
Well, under the principle that you were talking about before of acquiescence, where when someone does not respond to basically the specifics that you're sending them, they then agreed, would that not be further evidence if they don't respond? Or are you suggesting from your experience that if you were to put that in there, they would likely respond, making the claim that they weren't the ones that committed the fraud, depending on what you said, how they would respond? Or do you still think that you probably wouldn't get any response from them, and then you would then have evidence that they've acquiesced?
It's more of the other. I mean, you can ask, and they won't respond, and then you can say, see, I have a claim, and use it against them in some fashion or another. But anything you do after that point becomes adversarial. And you might win. It's hard to say because I haven't had anybody do that. So I don't know. Most of the people just kind of walk away from it saying they're happy to get the IRS out of their lives, off of their back, and they can move on. So.
Yeah, but if one. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, ask.
Yeah, so if one can't get a passport, it's likely to be an adversarial situation anyway. So I don't see how this would further, depending on what else your letter says, but the letters don't sound confrontational from what you said. I don't see how this would make it any more confrontational.
Well, it is kind of confrontational because I'm asking them questions, but I'm presenting it in such a way that I'm being polite. But that being said, I don't know because, like I said, nobody has come to me and said, I tried to get a passport. I couldn't do one after I filed your letters and everything. Nobody's ever told me that. So it could be that none of them have ever asked for a passport. They had passports to begin with and they didn't take them away. If they took them away, they may not have seen that it was related to the letters I sent. And so we can extrapolate a whole bunch of different scenarios out of what ifs, but I can't say until somebody like you says, I did this, I tried to get my passport, they wouldn't give it to me. Then I have some information to go by. Then we can take a look at whatever it is they sent to you or told you and see if there's a way to circumvent that. Sometimes there is. Sometimes it's really simple that it's right there in their laws and everything, and people just don't read or listen. I've had people tell me that they received frivolous letters from the IRS. This was non-related to what we're talking about now, but for other purposes. And so they got all upset and everything and looked at it. And when they showed me the letter, I said, this is not a penalty letter. This is a threat of a penalty. They went ahead and paid the $5,000 frivolous penalty fee for something they did not even ask for. So they voluntarily gave them $5,000 because they didn't read the freaking letter. Sometimes you have to read what it is they send you for you to figure out how you move next. If they say, well, we're not going to give you your passport because blah, blah, blah. Sometimes that blah, blah, blah means that you have to jump through one extra hoop that nobody else has ever heard of before, and you get your passport. I don't know, because we haven't come to that conclusion yet. I do know that those were the people that complained. I remember telling one person who was complaining about a frivolous penalty letter for another thing that we were doing at the time, and before these response letters and executor letters, and I said, well, what you need to do is take that letter in one hand and a match in the other and burn it. But please let go of the paper so it doesn't burn your hand. And, I got some chuckles out of that, but you know, I wanted to make sure that they were safe because they're not paying attention. They're not reading what's in front of them. So I don't know. I mean, again, we can speculate and go 100 different rabbit holes, but until something like that happens and it's brought to our attention, I can't say what the solution is. It might be a simple solution of sending them an executive letter saying that I want a passport. Maybe just that. And they may just say, okay, come in, pay your fee, and here's your passport. I don't know.
Okay, so at this point in time, the jury's still out on that, so to speak.
Yeah.
Good. Actually,
information, that's exactly correct, because, I could say a lot of different things. I could say, oh, yeah, sure, no problem, or, yeah, you're not going to ever get a passport again in your life. I don't know. The jury's out on that. So what's your next question?
Okay, so the next question is regarding state income taxes. Putting aside the passport issue for a minute and separating it from the passport issue. So out of about 50 states, there's several that have no income tax. There's, I think, very few that don't base the state income tax upon the federal form, but most of them thereabouts, I think it's 40 or so, do base it upon the federal form, give or take a few. Would you, if it's built on the federal form, have you come to the conclusion that if you solve the problem on a federal basis, the problem in those states that are based upon the federal form is then automatically solved or not so versus the states that don't work off the federal form?
My personal experience is that the states were a lot more difficult to deal with. The IRS was a lot easier than the state's taxing authorities. I was garnished until what they claimed that I owe for years that I wasn't working at the time was paid off, and I have not heard from the Oregon State income tax people since then, which has been a number of years now. So states can be a problem. Doesn't necessarily mean they are going to be a problem. There is a lot of internal problems to begin with because I have gone to IRS tax court, and I'm one of the few people who actually won and didn't know it until somebody pointed it out to me. then I did a 1099 OID trying to collect money that I spent throughout the previous years giving to the IRS, and there were a lot of people doing it at the time. I was just being part of the crowd, peer pressure. And some of those people got money back, lots of it. Some people went to jail. Some people got garnished. Some people, you know, it was very random. And have no, apparently we all followed the same plan, allegedly. Maybe we didn't. Maybe it was just different IRS agents or whoever was doing the forms says, oh, Dad, this is acceptable. This is done right. And somebody new comes up and says, oh, I never heard of this before. This is wrong, so we're going to do this. So it was all over the place, and that kind of messed up mine. And so there was a number of years where they claimed that I owed some money because I claimed it on my 1099 OID, and this causes conflict. And once the IRS says, hey, you owe this money, the state jumps in and says, hey, you owe this money. So that's when I started learning about the executor letter, did a response, did the executor letter, stopped the IRS, slowed down the Oregon Department of Revenue, but they kept on collecting until the alleged debt they claim I owed was gone. And I think the only reason they did that was because the IRS sent out something first, and then they jumped on that saying, hey, you owe the IRS, so you owe us. And that was a problematic to begin with. But once I got Oregon taken care of, I have not heard from them since.
Okay, so that was the state of Oregon, but you don't have any specific experience with any other particular letters for other states or the nuances of different states and the problems one might have with them?
No. I don't know if there were problems. There might have been, but most of the people probably had not done what I did and created a monster after I won from U.S. tax court. I made it complicated because I kind of jumped back in with another IRS form, and I could have just kept quiet and been out of it altogether. But instead, I had to learn something new. but I do not know what the other states would or wouldn't do. I would hope that most people would not have the situation that I had. So it should go smoother. And as far as I know, it has. But nobody's ever tells me, so I don't know. We talk about the IRS and doing that. I think there was a few states, California Franchise Tax Board, they were difficult, but I believe they all knuckled under, so to speak. So I don't remember or recall any issues with states per se, like what we're talking about, okay. Other mm-hmm. than my situation, which I kind of screwed up to begin with, which helped me learn about the executor letter and get them completely out of my lives and help a whole bunch of other people get them out of their lives too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want you to take any of my questions or comments as being in any way derogatory to what you're doing. I'm just trying to get more detailed answers on what the results were, so I want to be clear about that.
Sure.
And then the last issue that I want to mention, lastly, you were, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, you were sort of comparing the IRS to the military, that everything is voluntary until they actually get you to sign the contract. In the case of the military, you sign some paperwork, and they whisk you off to boot camp. In the case of the IRS, you send them a tax form on the bad advice of other people. And therefore, you've entered a contract with them. I don't want to belabor this point, but when we had the military draft back in the 60s and 70s for Vietnam, and people were under conscription, how would you conclude that that's voluntary? Or would you, upon thinking about it, think that perhaps that worked the way it did because people were really in the system, so to speak, and they hadn't corrected their status, which you could then come to the same conclusion as to what you're talking about with the IRS. If you would expand or expound on that, I'd appreciate it.
Let's see if I can understand that one. Back in when we had a draft, it failed miserably. Lots of people were drafted. Most of those people who went in wanted to go in, so the draft wasn't an issue for them. but there were other people who fled to Canada who did not want to partake in a war that we are not part of, and we were not being attacked. Other people went to war and ended up dead or got their troops dead because they did not want to be there. They didn't feel compelled to kill other people for a war that what didn't really involve them. And that's why they stopped the draft. They still have a pending threat or something that you register for in case they bring the draft back or something of that nature. But the truth of it is they're not going to bring it back, at least not that I'm aware of, unless we become a dictatorship of some kind, because drafts don't work for free people. If you're in a country where you don't have the freedoms we claim we have, then you have other issues and other requirements, and you grew up with those kind of ideas and everything. Like in Israel, I think everybody is expected to serve 2 years at minimum. Some people make it a career. Some people go in and out, you know, that type of thing. But as far as I know, the draft failed, and so they pulled it off, but they didn't want to make it look like they failed. So it's just like, well, we're taking it off the table, but it's still kind of there. So if you want a student loan, you have to mark the box that says that if called to a draft, you have to go or blah, blah, blah. But there was no draft. So we still have a voluntary system, and it works because you want people in the military who believe in what they're doing, because you're going to lose otherwise. Germany, back in World War One and World War Two, took a lot of people who did not want to be in the war. They did what they did because they're under orders, and they failed both times. And part of that is because they don't want to be there. If you don't want to be there and you're forcing people to be there, they're going to look the other way. They're going to turn their back. They're going to not point out certain things. They're going to be working for the other party because the other party is not forcing them to do something they don't want to do. You know, so when you force people into a situation, you're more likely to lose. So I don't see that as being that we have a draft. I just don't see that. It's voluntary. It has been voluntary. And that's the only way you're going to keep the military strong is by keeping it voluntary.
Okay. Let me just get some clarification on that. I was trying to relate this to what the origin of this call and the other similar calls are about regarding the correction of one's status. So I was looking at what you were saying or thinking about what you were saying regarding the IRS and the military. Is it possible that the only reason that, or the biggest reason, largest reason, that you're presumed to be part of this IRS system and available for military conscription or to volunteer into the military is because there's a presumption about your status? Because what you're saying, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, about your letters doesn't really necessarily have to tie in to a correction of status. You're simply, at least from the way you presented it, that's what I got a reading on. So how does this all fit together with the correction of status and who they presume you to be, and using your two examples, the military and the IRS? That's what I'm looking for a comment or a conclusion on, if you would.
Well, to be honest with you, I didn't hear. This is my first time calling in, and I didn't hear everything that had gone on before. So the comparison is unknown. But what I can tell you is that whether the IRS, because before I got involved with the response letter and the executor letter. I told the IRS to, because they would always send me letters in all uppercase, and I would say, I put my name in upper and lower case, I changed my last name, I changed my middle name, you know, I did all these different things, making them bounce around, and they complied every single time. It really kind of surprised me, and I was listening to other people who were having difficulty and doing all this other kind of stuff, and then I realized it doesn't matter how they spell your name or anything of that nature, because your Social Security number is attached to it. Therefore, they're going to treat you as a soulless entity. You volunteered into the system. You don't have any business being in the system because you're out of jurisdiction. You're not in commerce or international commerce anyway. And you're not located in their 10-mile limits or federal zones, territories. So, you know, you just chose to comply. And they're trying to find a way to make that happen without getting into trouble. So they treat you as a corporation. So you're a soulless entity to them, and they don't care what happens. So when we send off the response letter, I make a distinction between you as they see you, whether they use your middle initial or your middle name is irrelevant, but you want to make sure that you cover those bases. Then I bring up the estate, which is your first, middle, and last name estate. So there's like several spaces in between your last name, and then it's a comma and estate, so that everything that you're that belongs to this state is what they're talking about. And as such, you are then going in as the real man in upper and lower case, first and middle name only. You don't use your last name as the executor. And the executor is in charge of the estate. They cannot be in charge of the state anymore because you let your presence be known. So in that respect, correction of status, I don't know because I don't fully understand that. I know I've heard people talk about it, but what I understand is the executor is supposed to be the highest office, or the executor office is supposed to be the highest office in the land, because they don't have any authority over men and women. You know, as state men and women. If you are in a state, you're a man and woman, and you show up as a man or a woman, they don't have any authority over you. The executor has to be a man or a woman. It cannot be a corporation. Corporations do act as executor when nobody else is there. But as soon as somebody shows up, then the artificial entity has to disappear. I've seen this a number of times in doing executor letters and everything, that they just back off. And that's what the IRS does as well. They just back off because they know they don't have any authority as the executor of your estate. Who has? Because if you read through various court decisions and everything, you will find life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are part of your individual process, property. They are as much yours as a car or a horse or a wife or a husband if you you are a woman. These things are a part of you. And as the executor of your estate, your life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness belongs to you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense, and I appreciate your comments. But again, since this is a call, or not this particular call, but the calls deal with the correction of status, as you glean more information about that, I would appreciate that you would think about in a little more detail some of the questions I asked and how this might all fit together. If you don't mind doing that.
Well, I think claiming to be an executor is part of changing your or correcting your status. Maybe not in the same mode as what you're used to, but it is taking you from being an artificial entity controlled by the federal government or the IRS, depending upon how you look at them. Some people say the IRS is not part of the federal government, that they are a foreign entity. Other people say, no, they're part of it. They're under the Farm Act or something of that nature because they're part of the Federal Reserve that uses cotton to print their money, so on and so forth. So in some ways, it is correcting the status. It's just a different status, but it's all men and women. Bottom line, men and women are not controlled by the federal government, but you have to let them know that you're a man or a woman and not acting as a corporation. Because you can have corporations named after you. You know, you go down to New York, you see a Trump motel or hotel. It's named after him. It's an artificial entity. He's not, but he may not have separated himself from his property. You know, so the status needs to be corrected. Depends on what status you want corrected and what you want to do with it. Because in my mind, you are many, many things and can be many, many things. It just depends on what it is you want to do. Some people say that the birth certificates makes you an artificial entity. It's signed by the registrar who does probate court, so I see it as a will. It is designated as a will. You're a living will. Will tells the executor what they want done. You tell yourself what you want to do. So you are following your will. Or if you're religious, the will of God.
Mm-hmm. All right. Again, I appreciate your comments. And I think this requires, obviously, you know, some more thinking, depending on what someone's individual fact situation is. But I do agree with you that you can be many things. You can wear many hats at one time. And I had an attorney tell me that one time, demonstrating, which I didn't quite get it back in the early 1970s, when he reached behind his desk and pulled out different colored pillows and put them on his head. And see, now I'm this person with a yellow pillow on my head. Now I'm this person with a red pillow on my head, and basically what the message was. But I don't think that too many people, you know, back then understood that message. So I appreciate what you're doing. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. And, again, I think this requires some more thought. Thank you very much. There are more questions I could ask you, but I think in all fairness to everybody else, I'll leave those questions go for the time being. And thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Give us half a second here. We've got Ron in Cocoa, Florida. Go ahead, Ron.
Yes. Correcting your status is one subject, and the IRS situation with those over 50,000 is a separate distinction, and to me, they need to be separated, even though they are the tax issue has a conflict with separating her status, correcting her status, but it does not conflict with separating or correcting her status. It simply prevents from getting the passports, which is a second and separate action, in my opinion.
Yeah, but that's just it. It's your opinion. We don't know yet. And not until somebody comes forth and says, hey, I tried to get my passport, couldn't. Or, hey, I tried to get my passport, and here it is.
We don't know that it requires a separate action or anything else. Whether it's $10,000 or whether it's $500,000, if you volunteered in the system and it's fraud, it vitiates any contract. That's part of common law. And common law is the supreme law of the land. So right there, if it's done in fraud, and again, the IRS will claim to be innocent, but you bring up the information and say, is this true? And you point out a whole bunch of different things and tell them that you're not part of the tobacco, firearms, and all this other kind of stuff, because that's, as far as I can tell, that's where all their letters lead. You can follow them. I remember one time looking at one of the letters and noticing that they said 1040 code or 1040. And we all assumed that they were talking about the 1040 that we file and give to them every year. And we started looking at it and going, that's not what they're saying. And so we hunted down section 1040 and followed the various links, because they would say, blah, 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 according to section such and such. And it'd go all over the place, and it usually ended up with it talked about the estate. It talked about tobacco, firearms, and other things. You know, so it's all part of the same system. It looks more scary because over $50,000, they're supposed to take a different view. But if you don't know what it is you're doing, they don't care if it's $1 or $50,000. They're going to use the same tactics unless you point it out to them that they can't. Then all of a sudden it's, oh, well, we made a mistake. You know, so again, until somebody comes out and says, hey, we can't do this, and we have to take a look at whatever it is they send to you to determine what the next step is. You know, a lot, like I said, a lot of times it's right there. How many people knew that section 6012 had an exemption clause? Few. How many care? Some, I pointed it out to a number of people, and they say, that's interesting, and they let it go. And other people say, we're exempt? And I said, yes, you're exempt. It says right there, if you're married, if you're not married, if you're head of household, if you're not head of household, what are you? Well, I'm such and such. Well, are you head of household or not? You know, are you married or not? And most people don't look at and try to determine what goes next. And it is time consuming and it is difficult. So I understand some people's hesitant, but that's why I have an extremely long letter that explains it and goes over various things. And I just, I will just copy and delete or delete sections out of the letters, because not all of them pertain to the situation. Not everybody wants to ask all the questions, and I ask a lot of questions. The document's over 100 pages. By the time I'm done, it's about 30. Sometimes we can get it down to 15. It depends on how aggressive somebody wants to be. And again, we're being non-combative and polite, but we're firm and we want to make our points known. So I don't know what the situation is with passports at this time.
Okay. Anything else, Ron? We've got one more caller to be the last caller for the evening.
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
All right. Jennifer, go ahead.
Hi, everyone. I was just wondering, do you have to be $50,000 in debt to do this, or what if you get a refund from the IRS? Can you still do this? Because even though I get a refund, it's like I don't want to go through all the nonsense of tracking everything and doing the taxes and whatever.
If you want to claim, start with that. Claim your last refund, and then, well, what you would do, well, let's see, how to explain this in a succinct way. If you were going to claim a refund, then you would wait till the end of the year and go exempt December 31st or whatever your company allows, or depending upon weekends and holidays and all that other kind of stuff, when you decide to go exempt. Then you go exempt, and the new year, you're essentially free because you're exempt, and you would wait until they sent you a letter, because you're not going to send them anything. You're not part of their system anymore. But they don't know that. You haven't informed them. So when you are done, you file your last 1040 refund, collect the money, and probably sometime during that year, around usually if not before, then around November, they'll say, hey, you haven't been paying your taxes. We don't want you to get in trouble. They might do it sooner to keep you from going too far afield and having debts that you are unable to pay for. But whenever they send you a letter, that's when you contact them, and they will send you a form letter. All the form letters that I've seen thus far are, first of all, illegal, because you cannot send people a computer printout of anything. That has to be signed by an agent, and not a photostat copy of a signature. It has to be signed. And those are rare. They do happen, but still the law applies. If you are exempt, you are exempt. I don't care if they sign, if the commissioner talks to you himself. If you say you are exempt, you are exempt. Unless they can prove that you're a corporation involved in international commerce, mm-hmm. making a profit. So it doesn't make any difference how much the money is.
Okay.
What was the other question?
Oh, that was. I mean, I think you answered. I mean, I'm a 1099, not a W-2er, but I just wondered if you were, because I'm not in debt to the IRS, I just get refunds. Does that matter? I mean, can I still do the process to get out of their system altogether?
Do the protest? What was that? If you're talking about the exempt letter and response letter, that's not protesting. That's just informing them. I guess, in a sense, that's correcting your status. You're letting them know that you are not a person. Because one of the things I started looking through when I started looking through the IRS forms and everything is I came across one that, actually two different forms, that said that you are a non-U.S. citizen who wants to be treated as a U.S. citizen for taxing purposes. Did you sign such a letter or form?
I have no idea.
No.
I don't know.
Most have not. And I don't know who would under those circumstances, but I suppose it could be a foreign agent that wants to be treated as a U.S. citizen because maybe there's tax breaks or a business reason behind it. But as far as I know, nobody has signed that form that I talked to, or either one of those two forms. They are listed in the response letter saying, I never signed this. I never agreed to be treated as a U.S. citizen for taxing purposes.
Okay. I mean, I was Australian. I became American citizen. But I don't think I've ever signed a form saying I wanted to be treated like you just said. Sorry, I don't remember the exact words.
Well, again, you still have to be an artificial entity in the operation of commerce within their federal zone and earning a profit. So if you're not if you're not all of that, you're not required to pay an income.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, well, how much? What's your fee? Are you allowed to go into that?
Yeah, we haven't got that far yet. I wanted to get Scott on the I want to get Scott on the call tonight and just start talking about these things right now.
Okay.
And
the
focus that I'm working on is to find a shortcut, which, as I understand it, there's a preform a letter, if you would, that is generated that most of the time will stop the IRS from continuing. And then there's this executor letter that has nailed it shut when that has become necessary to do.
Mm. Right.
And that the purpose for this is so that people can who have, you know, a $50,000 plus issue with the IRS have a way to mitigate that so that they can move forward and get their passport and so forth. Anyways, that's what we're doing with that, or what we're looking at. So I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. I hope you enjoyed Scott, perhaps we'll be hearing from him again soon. Want to share that Bernie's call will be this Saturday regarding asset protection. Join us again Monday when GW will join us regarding correcting her status. And then we'll be back again Tuesday, a week from now. Until then, good night, everybody. And be well.
Good night, everybody.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Thank you.
Thank you.